The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I just came back from teaching a week-long retreat. I have the very good fortune to not have anything on my mind. We could spend the evening talking about how wonderful that is, given some of the alternative possibilities that people do with their minds. But I thought that it might be a nice evening if you'd like to ask us any questions, and we can have some discussion, or I could try to reply, or if you have any particular requests that you want to hear something about. Yes, is there a mic on this? And it'd be nice if you said your name when you spoke, just so we have a little more sense of community here.
How's that? That's it? I'll cut to the chase here. At the very end of my meditation, I was thinking very fondly about buying another set of Makita tools. I had just bought them for a friend of mine, a guy who works for me, and I got him a very nice set. I was just very pleased. It was a great present. And he showed them to me. I thought, boy, those are better than anything I've got. Though I've got all the same things. So then I started to think, this isn't really very Buddhist. There ought to be something that would make me happier than these new tools, which wouldn't make me very happy very often. So I'm so glad that you've made yourself available to answer that question for me. What would make me happier than these Makita tools? And they are very good tools. And I could give you more details if you'd like.
Maybe you answered the question, because you're for yourself. You said that, if I understood what you said, you gave him the tools, and he was so happy to have them, he showed them to you, and made your day. It really made you happy to. Is that what you said?
Yes.
That's what's better than getting the tools for yourself.
Well, I've already done that.
Well, maybe you find someone.
It's time to get them for myself, don't you think?
Two things. There might be someone else you can give another set of tools to.
I should get them for myself and test them out to be sure they're good enough.
If you can afford to buy it for yourself, then maybe find someone else to give the gift to, and you get to feel that joy and delight, and the joy and delight might last a lot longer down through time than it is that you get them. That's one thing that occurs to me. And the other thing is that still has to do with, I guess, the delight, the joy, the appreciation that your friend had getting the present. I would worry a teeny bit that if you got one also, do you guys work together sometimes?
All the time.
Just wait a little while. Because if you got the same thing, it might set up a little bit different dynamic for him. Maybe it's not quite as special for him, or it just kind of augments, you know, his happiness to be able to see you struggling with your old tools. But the short answer is that helping other people to be happy rather than you being happy is sometimes a better thing. So you ask what's better. Yes, up here in the front. Just coming to your left.
Right here, babe.
My left.
Okay.
I've been wondering lately about...
Your name?
Oh, Trudy. I've been wondering about memory. And where memories fit in the scheme of things when we're practicing. Memories can be pleasant, and is that pleasure a distraction? Memories can have all kinds of emotions attached to them. And I just wonder about, can memories be useful in our practice or to be avoided as distraction or what?
They can be both. They can be both. They can be useful if you ask the question that way. If you remember that you were distracted by memories yesterday and it didn't really serve you very well, then when the memories come today, you can say, you know, I remember this doesn't really go anywhere useful. I'll let go of them. But if it's the first time you've ever had a memory, it might be hard to let it go. Or you might have a memory that when your practice is strong, that there are better things than memory. The pleasure of memory is nice, but there are better things. So for meditation, that's what I would say. Something like that. I think for meditation, there are times where it's useful. You get lessons, you remember lessons, lessons that teach you something about the meditation itself. And those memories serve your meditation. Because in meditation, you're actually not trying to remember and not trying to feel the pleasure of memories, because the idea is there's actually better things to experience in meditation. There's better goals, better possibilities than riding along memory lanes. Outside of meditation, it's wonderful sometimes to sit and have memories, have a cup of tea, and remember wonderful things and feel that pleasure. I mean, that can be an innocent, wonderful event to remember. But in meditation, we generally discourage it.
Thank you.
Hi, Gil. My name is Jonathan. So I met someone a couple days ago, and I told him that I come here sometimes. And he asked me if he was, I think, curious about the practice, and he wants to sort of learn a bit more about meditation, but he specifically is interested in how meditation can help him with his substance abuse and addiction issues. And he asked me about that, and I didn't have any experience with that, so I told him, I'm going to see Gil on Monday. I'll ask him.
Great. We do have a recovery group here at IMC. So in terms of bringing those two together, specifically doing something which is maybe helpful for addiction issues, and doing meditation and discussing it. We have this group that meets once a month on Sunday evenings. So that's a possibility to bring those two together explicitly. There's many ways in which mindfulness can help with substance abuse or substance issues that people have. One of them has to do with being able to track oneself better, to see the symptoms and signs, to really recognize in oneself the signs, the symptoms that come along that we're in danger. Because generally, if someone has an ongoing problem with substance, it's often trying to compensate for some suffering, some distress that they might have, and so there are times with stress or other things that come along when we're much more susceptible to, you know, drinking or taking drugs. And so to be able to be mindful enough to see the symptoms earlier, get early warning signs really early, and then learn how to do something different that's more healthier and more healing, more better for you, is possible. Because if those signs or those stressors build up, we don't see them coming, then we get to a point where we act impulsively, or the craving is so strong that it's almost like no choice. So to be able to be calm enough, centered enough, and familiar enough with oneself to see it coming and know what to do and know what alternatives to do is one thing that mindfulness can help with. It takes time and a lot of attention, but that's one thing. The other is if a person is really motivated strongly to not take the substance, that's really their heart's wish. Meditation can teach you a lot of discipline, a lot of self-control. I mean, you sit and meditate, and you know, if your practice in meditation is basically not to move, and not to follow your thoughts, or not to follow your cravings or your aversions, and you sit there and are mindful for it in a certain kind of way, just to keep letting go or not giving into it, it's a powerful training. And so we train ourselves in meditation to do that. And so every time that you let go of a thought in meditation, you get a little bit stronger and not following it along. Every time you have a strong desire in meditation, you say, no, I'm going to go back to my breathing. You get stronger in that kind of certain kind of discipline. And that muscle gets stronger and stronger. So lo and behold, you walk by a liquor store and you feel the urge to go in, and I can let go of that. You know, I know what desire is like. I can let go. And then another thing that meditation helps with is that is one of the things. Probably one of the closest things the Buddha said around this particular issue is that it gives a person a sense of happiness, well-being, that's so much greater and better than the addiction. And so the balance is so much more in favor of not doing than doing the substance, because a person knows something really healthy and good that's really some of the best quality happiness, well-being that a person can experience in life. The utmost happiness, the utmost pleasure can come from meditation. So is that, what do you think? Is that, then you think that's work for him, or should we try some more?
No, I think that's very helpful. So the three things that I'll try to remember much of what you said as possible, but so awareness, discipline, and a sense of well-being, and then...
Perfect.
Yeah. All right, cool. And I'll tell him about the group that meets once a month on Sundays?
Yeah, one Sunday evening a month. I'm not sure exactly. Maybe the third one?
I believe it's every second Sunday.
The second Sunday.
Thank you.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yes.
Just to mention, if you forget this talk is also recorded and on audiodharma.org, so feel free to reference that as well.
Hello. Thank you. My name is Avi, and I have this desire of constantly feeding myself with something, you know, just like after this meditation for about an hour, you know, I can just go by without any music or nothing playing on the side, and I can just be silent, you know, my ambience within myself and outside. But after that, like you're driving or you're just sitting there and working, I need something playing on the background, you know, like something is missing. Like it's not that I desire something. It's just like the vacuum is just puts too much thought in my head. Mm-hmm. Like, how do I go about not craving, you know, some kind of podcast, some kind of music, or some kind of input?
Thank you. That's a great question. I think it's a question that probably many people have as well. And but what has given you what has happened to you? What's been your experience that you're asking so sincerely, so seriously around this question? You must have some wisdom or some understanding that says, you know, that this is important enough you're asking.
Well, I feel like after this hour of meditation, I feel really calm. I feel really, you know, really at ease. But on the other hand, when a desire arises to have something constantly playing in the background, it's in those times when I'm like a little tense, and it's probably the craving for these moments, like this ease being at, you know, I probably want to extend these or something. And
That's wonderful. So you have a treasure. You discovered something really precious. So I think one thing to do is to appreciate what's just happening to you. Sometimes really appreciating something lets it live in us stronger. So that was really well said. The other is, this is where mindfulness is very useful, is when you find yourself wanting to do music, podcast, do something that's distracting or fills the void, for a little while at least, don't do it. And instead, really study. Maybe, you know, just stop whatever else you're doing too. Maybe sit and close your eyes and turn inwards to see what's really going on for you. Become an expert. Really become like you're going to get a PhD. On Avi or Abhi? Yeah. Avi. What happens in you when you have this craving for the music? Are you lonely? Are you scared? Are you, do you feel somehow bereft, lost? Do you have thoughts which are painful? And you're trying to mask or hide from, you know, difficult thoughts that you might be having. What's really going on? But not just the first one or two or three impressions of what's going on. Really, really see if you can really take a deep, deep, honest look. And then, after you've gotten to know it well, ask yourself the question that this need that you have for music, or this need to meet this inner thing that's happening for you, is there a healthier way to deal with it? Is there a better way to respond to it, to work with it? And based on what you said this evening, it's possible meditation is a better way. And so maybe to meditate more often.
Yeah, I've tried to incorporate it like thrice a day, maybe sometimes in the morning, 20 minutes in the daytime, and sometimes before sleep. That helps, but it's a short period. That's what's been happening. Yeah. And I'll definitely... about your input.
And the other thing that's interesting to do is if you can't really quite quit doing it, you're still doing it, and it's, you know, I think interesting is to not do it. And try a few times. What I suggest is, I think I'd still recommend, stop and really take a look at what's going on with you. Another thing you can try is maybe three times when it comes along, and simply refuse to give into it. Just like it's an exercise. Like, no way am I going to do it. I'm going to see this through, and I'm going to see this through until that desire is not there, or I have to go have dinner or something. And see what happens if you don't give into it and get to the other side. That's something. The other thing to do is to sometimes if you can't beat something, begin changing it just a little bit in a healthy direction. So if you're listening to music and meditation, you like meditation, it helps you, but you can't avoid the music to kind of fill whatever is going on for you, go find music that's meditation music. So, still music, but it's kind of like pointing you in the direction of the meditation, reminding you of it. And that might be a nice transition. Some of those ideas okay with you? Great. Thank you.
My name is Jane. And to tease out a little bit more of what he was saying, I notice there's times when I'm not in practice that my mind will start to wander and I want to stop it, because my wandering mind has not always been my friend. And if you could speak a little bit more to, I think I have an anticipation of possibly what's next, if I can either train myself not to do that or to maybe understand that there is something on the other side of that.
Right, yes. So, there's all kinds of options you have with that. One would be simply to let go of your wandering mind as soon as quickly as you can when it comes up. And slowly, over time, some of the energy for distraction will abate, and the energy for being present will grow, and it just, the balance shifts in a nice way. Another thing to do, which sometimes is maybe wiser, because it produces more understanding of what's happening, is if you're mindful, on a day when your mindfulness seems strong enough, you might try very gently or something, go along with the wandering mind. Don't stop it. Don't let go of it. Let it go. But your mindfulness is strong enough that you watch it. Like you're not in it, but you watch it happen, and you study it. You understand, what is this? What's happening emotionally? What's just like with the music we talked about. What is it trying to? Is it meeting a need? Is it covering up a loneliness or anxiety? Or is there a really? I just have a lot of desire for tools, and you know. And so I'm just like to think about these things that I want. What's going on? Try to get wise about what's going on with you, because if you just simply let go of your wandering mind over and over again, you might not see what's triggering it. What need it's trying to fill or what it's trying to do. So when the mindfulness is strong, you don't get sucked into it, but you can watch it happen. You can learn a lot about yourself.
Thank you.
And then, and it's also very interesting that there might be a day where your mindfulness is strong enough, but at the same time, the drive to wander off in thought is super strong. And what you might try doing is think, today is not going to be a very pretty, enjoyable meditation. That's okay. Today, the successful meditation is going to be that I grit my teeth, get tense, and I'm not going to give in to the wandering mind. I'm just going to really not going to do it. And because the wandering mind is so strong, unless you do that, you will wander off. And that's an interesting exercise to do, at least once. Most people want to meditate because they want to relax. But sometimes you want to get a handle on or see or get a new relationship with the whole thinking mind, and to really kind of steel yourself up and really be a warrior and really, like, I'm not going to give in whatsoever. At least once, try that. And see if that takes you to the other side and what happens. Yeah, right. I saw this man here had a hand up before.
Hi, my name's Joel. I really dislike speaking publicly,
especially with a mic.
Yeah, especially with a mic. I don't so much have a question as much as I'd just like to share with everyone. As I've struggled with my own battles with addiction, meditation practice has been really helpful for me. And so I really, after a year of not practicing my meditation, I came here tonight and was really just moved and felt so fulfilled to be able to be here tonight and honored by everyone's presence and connection. As far as your friend goes, there's also a Dharma and recovery group that meets once a month in the North Bay Meditation Center, and also there's a group that meets once a month in a Berkeley Buddhist temple. They're both really helpful and really positive. In addition, there's a book by Gabor Mate called The Hungry Ghosts, which is really powerful and has helped me along the way despite my own hiccups along the road. I've kind of lost my train of thought, but I want to thank everyone here for just being here and putting positivity into the world is a really powerful thing that everybody's doing, and I appreciate that a great deal.
Joel, thank you very much for both all of that. I appreciate it. Especially since it's hard for you to speak this way. Thank you.
Yes? I had a question over here. Thank you for opening this up to questions. My name is Simon, and I've had kind of a large decision in my life coming up imminently. And as I'd been kind of meditating quite a bit, I naturally kind of intuitively said, I'm going to meditate on it. And then I kind of quickly realized I didn't really know how to meditate on a decision specifically. So I was curious to hear your thoughts on that, and if you have any input, I could kind of share some of my process so far, if that's helpful. And I have come to understand now that my kind of like logical, linear thinking mind is not going to be an effective tool at grappling with these kind of complex systems of life and anticipating and predicting the future. So more or less I just figured I'm just going to sit and clear my mind, and it's going to come to me what needs to be done.
Maybe so. What I've discovered for myself when in times of my life I had to make a big decision is that it's actually useful for me to spend a lot of time thinking about it. I go for walks and I think about it. I'm driving around my car, I'm thinking about it. I think about it, but I've learned that the answer is not going to come from the thinking. So it used to be in the beginning I was thinking in order to get the answer. But I learned over time that the answer is not going to come from my thinking, but the thinking is creating the conditions in the mind for the mind to do its work in this way, when I'm least expecting it, when I'm doing something different and I've forgotten what I'm, they have this issue, that's when something comes back. Oh, now I know what to do, and I've gotten crystal clear. But if I just thought on the thinking, it doesn't help, it's not useful. Then I'm not getting kind of the momentum going or the synergy going or the power of the mind going, the churning going. So something's working offline in the back, room. So thinking is, so again, for, I guess I'm repeating myself. For me, thinking about it is helpful, but it's not where the answer comes from. But it does create the conditions for the answer to come a different way.
That's extremely helpful, because I think I've really just had an aversion to thinking about it. And I've just been sitting and have had some just, quietness of the mind, but there was nothing really that was coming up that was clearly giving me a sign, or there was no sense of intuition about knowing which of the two paths that I should take. So
yeah, your mind needs to be working the problem.
Yeah. You have to do
some kind of input, if you know that your thinking mind is not going to provide the answer, then you don't have to invest so much in it, and be sitting there kind of like a cat at the mouse door waiting for the answer if you figure it out, or feel bad because you can't figure it out. You're not supposed to figure out, but you are supposed to kind of put the juice into the. The ingredients into the soup.
Great. Thank you.
And then it's really good. So meditation can be very helpful for this process, because when you've done your part of it, which is, churning away with it for a while, then when you quiet the mind in meditation, maybe you're not thinking about, then sometimes that's the time when some deeper background process in the brain has a chance to operate. It's like you've kind of cleared the room or cleared the space for some deeper processing to happen. And that's the kind of situation where something new can arise that was unforeseen.
But I appreciate that. Thank you.
Good. Great. Straight back. There was the other mic.
Hello. Hi, my name is John. I actually found
this place 5 years ago as an alternative to my 12-step group. There's a book by an author named Griffin that's about Buddhist recovery as well.
Kevin Griffin, called One Breath at a Time.
Yeah, there's a couple of them.
It's a really good book.
That's a great one. That helped me in a time of crisis. Over the years, I've had some sobriety and had a child, and I hadn't been coming here as much. Thankfully, I was able to do that because of I found this place and some other support. But lately, I had a slip, and I found myself back in 12-step a couple weeks ago for the last couple weeks. And I was speaking with my therapist and basically agreed with her that if I had a good week, I would come here. And if I had a bad week, I would go to my 12-step group.
Fantastic.
And it's the same time. It starts at 7:30. It's on Mondays, and it's basically the same direction. I just turn left left to the meditation and right to the 12-step. So I'm hoping I'll be back next week. But thank you very much.
I'm happy to know you have a nice alternative. They both support you. It's very good. You're lucky to have it.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Without making a big deal about it, Kevin Griffin is the one that runs, at least last I checked, was the first Friday of every month at Insight in the North Bay.
Spirit Rock?
Spirit Rock, yep. And the last, I forget, Tuesday or Thursday of every month in Berkeley.
Yeah. Yeah, Kevin's great. I like him a lot. And there's other kind of Buddhist recovery groups around. San Francisco Zen Center in San Francisco has a big group, and different things you can go do. In the back.
Scott, I have been wrestling with a bit of what seems to me a paradox, coupled with a feeling of being a hypocrite. And it stems from the fact that it feels like we're engaging in a practice of seeking a sense of happiness or solace, almost desiring this. But at the same time, aren't we engaged in a practice to not want to engage in desire? So I'm wanting something, engaging in a practice, which I'm not supposed to want something. And there's like this loop. And I'm saying, well, am I missing something? What is going on here? Is it a different type of desire? Is it the wrong or right type of desire? Though I don't like those adjectives. But that's what I've been wrestling with for quite some time.
I think that you're right. There are different types of desires. And so we're not all desires are equal in terms of being problematic. And it's the problematic desires we want to become free of. And so in Buddhist language, the problematic desires are usually called craving. There are desires that have compulsivity to them, and we don't have much choice. We're not free in relationship to them. And those desires which are for things that are harmful for ourselves or for other people, we want to avoid those as well. But there are desires that involve no compulsivity, that have no craving, that we're free in doing, but they're really healthy for us. They're healthy for us, healthy for others, healthy for the world. And they're ones that support us, nourish us, help us to thrive, internally thrive and become better people. And those we want to kind of act on and live by. In the Buddhist sense, if we're doing Buddhist practice and really tuning in mindfully and carefully to what's going on, we'll also start discovering at some point that there is, at certain points, like in meditation, there's also some tremendous benefit in letting go of the mental activity that desiring requires. In meditation, we let go of it. So we learn that, because there's even desire for healthy things, and can be a little bit tiring and stressful for the mind. It can be a little bit of a drag to always be thinking the same thoughts over and over again. And so just because it's a healthy desire and we feel pretty free in having it, doesn't mean it's to our best interest to keep thinking about it. And so in meditation especially, we learn to let go. At some point, we learn to let go of even good desires. But hopefully, we don't like going forever, but at least in order to have the deeper rest in the mind, the deeper clarity of the mind, we have to learn to let go of those so we can see more deeply. So there is something true about what you said about we're learning to let go of desire, but in that sense, we have a desire for the letting go of desire. We have a desire for what's better than desire. And that's fine to have, because as you get to the edge of that, it's clear you have to let go of that too. But until you get to the edge of it, it serves you. Go along with it. Is that clear enough? It's a little complicated.
Thank you. It's something to continue reflecting on.
Okay. So I think, if my memory, is not so good, but I have sensed there's a whole bunch of men have asked questions recently in the series. Are some of the women would like to ask? Yes.
Do you want me to go?
Please.
My name is Bethany, and I have two daughters, 5 and 10, and I've been thinking a lot about forgiveness as a parenting tool. It's something that doesn't roll off the tip of my tongue. My younger daughter has some behavioral challenges, so she has big reactions. To things like the wrong bowl at the breakfast table, or So
the carrots are not in the on the plate in the
right.
way that
yeah, not they, lined they, up right.
They usually outgrow
be
it, but it's like this parenting thing.
Yeah. So, you want to teach them that. Hitting or kicking is not okay. But sometimes when I go in to explain to her that her behavior is not okay, that ramps up her behavior because she feels bad about it on top of feeling the big emotion. And so there have been a few times where I've thought, you're okay, you're okay, you're still loved, but it's hard to find that line between now am I coddling, am I allowing, am I spoiling the child? So I've just been trying to figure out how to get the forgiveness in, but also teach her to be aware of her behavior and how the world
yeah,
works.
It's a great question. I wonder if maybe forgiveness is not the quite the issue in the junctures you're talking about. I think that when the kids are young, and maybe when they're older, absolutely the role of the parents is to say you can't to intervene so they don't cause harm, they don't kick and bite the other kids, or bite you even, or whatever they do. Forgiving them doesn't seem like the right thing to do because you haven't taught them that to stop doing it. But how to get them to stop doing it in a way that they don't feel shamed or experience anger from you, but where it's very definitive. If the two kids are fighting and you just kind of step right into the middle of it and sit down and say, I could see that you guys are fighting, and I kind of think if I sit here in the middle, maybe that'll stop it. And that no one's been blamed. It's just like you just do something. Like, oh. As you were speaking, I remembered when I was 14. I told this story, but when I was 14. My friend and I came across my keys to my father's car. And so we thought we would try to drive it. And I think neither one of us knew how to drive. And so we got in the car and turned on the engine, and the car was parked right next to a bulldozer. And when the engine got turned on, the car kind of lurched forward and hit the bulldozer. The bulldozer was fine. But my father's car got banged in. And so I called my father on the phone and said, you know, this thing happened and we crashed your car into a bulldozer. And he just said, does it still drive? And I said, yes, but we can't open the passenger door. And he said, why don't you see what you can do about it, then I'll look at it when I come home. And that's the end of it. Never heard anything about it again. And maybe my voice was such that he understood that I felt bad and that there was no need to be angry with me. But I got a big lesson about acceptance, about not being angry, about kind of finding your way with these things. That was a powerful thing for me to go through. So something equivalent. Sometimes when kids are acting out a lot and they're hitting, they have a need. And more chances are they need love. They need care. They need attention. And so how to offer them a little bit of attention and love without condoning what they did or without doing it as a reward for what they did. Occasionally with my kids are growing up, I use distraction. All the things which I train people not to do when I meditate. it seems like good strategies as parents sometimes. They have so many strategies. But distraction sometimes worked, and just the whole issue kind of went away temporarily, and it doesn't escalate, doesn't make it worse. And this matter of fact, just telling them, no, this we don't do that here. Nope, we don't do that here in this house. And then, you know, if you continue this, then, I'll go with you into the bedroom. Sometimes my son was misbehaving, and I couldn't stop it. I said, okay, it's time to go in your room. And he would be furious, and I would pick him up, because he was still small, and I'd take him to his room, and I'd close the door. But I'd stay in the room with him. So I wasn't abandoning him in there. I'd sit down on the door, so I could block the door. Clearly he couldn't leave. And I say, you know, it's fine for you to be angry, but we're just going to sit here until you calm down. So I don't know if this gives you some ideas, but your question is great. I think most parents have to deal with this kind of question. And to really give time to it and reflect on it and learn alternatives and ask other parents. And it's really, really important because the instinct people have to be, to punish the kids or be angry, doesn't serve them in the long term. So, you know, finding a healthy alternative is really, really good. Okay, well, it's 9 o'clock, and it's very important that these young kids go to bed on time, because then they're better behaved the next day, and it might be true for adults too. I hope you all go home and at your usual bedtime, go to sleep and contentedly happy, and wake up and be loving people for this world tomorrow. Thank you.